Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So Simon Edwards is a member of our board and a good supporter, and one of the main reason why we have this function on tonight, because Simon drew our attention to Alastair Wilson. So Simon Edwards is going to introduce our speaker. Thanks.
Good evening, everyone. It's quite a pleasure and a very unusual pleasure to be introducing tonight's speaker. I was just saying to Jared beforehand, I don't think I can remember in all my years at the Sydney Institute that Jared Henderson hasn't introduced the speaker. So I'm feeling a bit nervous now. And I'm not intending to be a new Jared Henderson, I can assure you of that. This evening's speaker is Alastair Wilson, the Chief Executive of the School of Social Entrepreneurs in the United Kingdom. It's a great pleasure to have Alastair in the country. And over the past 12 years, he has been a leader in the development of the UK social entrepreneurship and social innovation sector, something to which many of us have tried to follow but not necessarily understood with perhaps the depth of clarity that perhaps we'll find out tonight. Together with Unlimited and Ashoka, Alistair has been a driving force in developing a social entrepreneurship manifesto, advocacy on behalf of those that start and lead new organisations for social change. He's also a trustee of Unlimited, a foundation for social entrepreneurs, the London Funders Group, the Social Entrepreneur Enterprise Coalition, and the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. I will speak for about 30 minutes and then we'll take questions and answers. His topic for tonight is Social Entrepreneurs and the Big Society, the Future of the Social Economy in the UK. And as many of us know, it's quite a challenging situation in the UK at the moment, both in terms of their economy and what it means for their society and the many changes, both political, cultural and social, that are underway. So please join me in welcoming Alistair.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's a real thrill to be here at the Sydney Institute, and thank you so much for inviting me to speak to you all today. I wonder if many of you have heard of the concept of the big society. Is that filtered over in terms of the papers and the news? A few nods, a few shakes of the head. We have a new coalition government, which is Tory-led, Conservative-led, and Liberal Democrat in the minority. And this really was a flagship policy of the new coalition government. The manifesto that they put out prior to the election was a manifesto written to the general public to author their place in this new government. And what they were saying was, they were saying, over to you guys, government can't get these social issues, they can't grapple with them and get them right. We want to empower communities to come forward with their solutions that they understand and bring those to the fore. So it really was quite a radical vision, the big society, but there's been a bit of struggle since they've come to power in terms of truly understanding what that means and how to engage with that. So what I'm going to try and do with the half hour I've got to speak tonight is, first of all, tell you a little bit about the School for Social Entrepreneurs and how we support social entrepreneurs in terms of bringing solutions to social problems to the fore. And then I'll go on to reflect a little bit on what I think the big society is trying to achieve and a few of the debates or discussions that are coming to the fore around the big society. So I just want to touch on this chap here, Michael Young. Some of you might have heard of Michael Young. He was a serial social entrepreneur who throughout his life, Michael died about 6 years ago, throughout his life he started probably 40 national and international social enterprises, if you like. So he invented everything from the Open University to Language Line to Education Extra, the School for Social Entrepreneurs. I believe which magazine over here is called Choice Magazine, and the Translation Services Language Line, which is international, is called TIS over here as well. Michael was a remarkable man. I was lucky enough to work with him for a number of years. In terms of the way he worked, and I suppose to get a handle on how a social entrepreneur works, it's nice to hear a little story of how he goes about his business. Michael was mad keen for a cup of tea. We're based in Bethnal Green in East London, and he came back one day and popped a kettle on, and the kettle had been boiled dry, so somebody had broken it. He went straight out to the electrician's shop, bought a kettle, brought it back, filled it with water, and pressed go. It was a very slow boiling kettle. And obviously Michael was a man in a rush, he had plenty of things to do, so he went straight back to the electrician's shop and bought a second kettle. So he didn't take the first one back, he bought a second kettle. Put the two kettles side by side and filled them both with equal quantities of water and pressed go and measured the boiling time of both kettles. Then he wrote on a document, which, question mark, or choice if you're an Australian, choice, question mark, first edition, which kettle, the boiling times of these two kettles. And then called a press conference in a Park Lane hotel to launch which magazines. So, and he was quite surprised actually, he got a fairly good turnout. Came back to Bethnal Green. The next day, a black cab pulled up outside Bethnal Green, and black cabs wouldn't come to the East End in those days. And this chap got out in a pinstripe suit and came to the door, knocked on the door. Might I have a copy? And this is 1950. Might I have a copy of which magazines? And Michael said, oh, it was a bit faff because there was no such magazine. It was a carbonated handwritten copy of The Boiling Times of Two Kettles. He gave him this copy and he said, might I ask you where you're from? And he said, yes, I'm from Baker Street in Marks and Spencer's in Baker Street in London. And Michael knew that if he had the retailers worried, he was on to something. And which magazines was the fastest growing charity in Britain ever at that point. It had 800,000 subscribers pretty much overnight, and it dividends all its profits to the Consumers Association, who fights on behalf of the poor for things like access to basic bank accounts, basic utilities, etc., and therefore can't really take government grants or sponsorship because they want an independent voice in order to fight on behalf of the poor. So you can see, and I could tell you many, many other stories of how Michael started his various institutions, but basically he often did something or tried something or tested something, and if it worked, he had many ideas that didn't work, but if it worked, he would scale it and try and grow it. Now, Michael believed that entrepreneurship or social entrepreneurship was a doing word. He believed you couldn't teach it, but he thought you could learn it by doing, and hence he set up the School for Social Entrepreneurs as an action learning institution. Now what that means is that means that we have a load of people that come to us every year with their idea, their which magazines, the thing they're passionate about, and they come and spend a year on program with 20 people in a cohort trying to realize that idea and make it happen. Now they don't have teachers or lecturers or curriculum or content, because Michael believed that entrepreneurship, actually the most important hurdle or difficulty to people who were trying to start something from scratch, something new, was actually softer skills like confidence or legitimacy or attitude or mindset or behaviour or persistence. And you can't teach those as a lecturer with content, but actually you can learn them by having a go at starting your thing and getting a bit more confident. And also by learning from your peers, the other 20 people in your cohort who are trying to start their social enterprise. And also from hearing from stories from other people who have started those things. So we bring in what we call witnesses, who are social entrepreneurs who have started from scratch a whole load of social innovation agencies. And they tell their story, warts and all, difficulties and all. And that helps our students get a handle on how they're going to behave and how they're going to push forward and pilot and make successful their organisations. So that's the perspective I'm coming from. Now, to kind of orientate you in this space, because this is all kind of jargony words, I mean, social entrepreneurship, well, we've had good people doing amazing, innovative things forever and a day, so this is a bit of a rebrand on this stuff, and social enterprises, the idea of trading and re-employing the excess finance into doing more good social work. Well, again, that idea has been around forever and a day. So just in terms of these new terminologies, let me try and orientate you in terms of how it looks in the UK now. So in the old days, it was very clear, we understood what it all meant, private sector, public sector, and voluntary and community sector or charity. So we had three distinct sectors. Then about 10, 15 years ago in the UK, people started speaking about the social enterprise sector as a kind of structural term but there was no distinct legal form for the structural term. You know, this means something, private sector. We understand that there's ownership behind that. Public sector, well, that's tax-based services. Voluntary community sector, well, we understood what that meant. And then social enterprises, this notion of trading for a social impact. So, you know, products and services, making an income, and then reemploying the income to a social purpose. Where do social entrepreneurs operate? Well, if you think about it, if you start with an idea from scratch, you don't have a legal form, so you're not in any of these boxes. You come with an idea to the School for Social Entrepreneurs from scratch, new idea, an innovative idea. Most of them tend to pick a legal structure as they go through a year and end up in either of these two boxes here. And to give you an example, this is a woman called Rose Spearing. Rose lives in Brixton in South London. In her local school, loads of boys were being excluded for bad behaviour and were ending up in her housing estate, causing mayhem in terms of trouble in the stairs and with drugs and knife and gang stuff going on. And Rose had a great idea around horse riding and starting something called Ebony Horse Club, which engaged these boys in achieving things, you know, achieving attainment, passing exams, turning up on time, and really got them more confident, more able to re-engage. And what they've done as a result in terms of people getting back into the mainstream schooling system is absolutely remarkable. And it's quite a remarkable sight as well to see horses trotting around Brixton, which is a South London suburb as well. And it's now an Olympic legacy project. So the most fabulous building is being built, which is going to house these horses and all these kids. And it really works. It gets really dysfunctional kids who've been booted out of school back in school. So it's fantastic. It's absolutely held by the community, Rose and all the other parents of the kids are making that happen. So that's Rose. The next example is Junior. Junior started up something called SOS Gangs Project. Junior was involved in gang problems in South London and as a result spent 12 years in prison. He felt when he was released from prison that it was impossible for him not to re-engage in all the old mates that he had and all the old social circles he had, which was a direct route back to reoffending and back into prison. And SOS Gangs Project, which Junior started, works intensively with prisoners prior to release and meets them at the gates on release to try and get them back in, to try and prevent them from reoffending. Again, remarkably successful. Junior's had over 100 people through his ranks. The reoffending rate for young black men in London between the ages of 18 and 24 is 72% within 2 years, and Junior's got that down to 17%, and he's dealt with over 100 people. Now, this should, imagine if the state tried to do that with probation officers, well, I mean, which they have been doing. They've not been doing it very well. But somebody who really understands these guys and can empathise and understands the communities they're coming from can offer a service that's built to last, that's popular, that's authentic, and actually works. So a remarkable story. The next one, Bikeworks guy Dave. This is an amazing story as well. The Metropolitan Police donate all their stolen bikes. So bikes are stolen. Go to the Met Police. They're donated to Bikeworks. People who've had severe mental health troubles are trained to refurbish the bikes and they sell them in a big retail shop and all the money goes back to getting more people into employment. They run three groups on a Saturday and Sunday, which are huge groups, so 100 people or more, which are volunteer-led, and they go and they have three primary care trusts in East London who give prescriptions for depression, not of tablets, but of cycling and group cycling. So a whole load of volunteers go up on a Saturday morning and knock up these people who are depressed and in their house and say, come on, come out. And they take them all on a big cycling tour. And Bikeworks gets money from the NHS for doing that. Again, hugely successful because loneliness, isolation, you know, are two of the big problems that people who are depressed and down face. So again, very innovative, very local. You know, pairing together stolen bikes, meaningful occupation, you know, groups of people, volunteerism. And these are all illustrations of what this concept or this notion of big society is. Last example, if it will come up. Yeah, it's whole school meals. This is an incredible one. This is an amazing woman. She's called Stephanie. School meals, primary school meals in Britain, pretty shocking. Her county council, Kent County Council, decided to outsource all school meals. A whole lot of private companies tendered for the contract. And Stephanie and a whole lot of other parents decided to go for it and tender for it. And she said she got the shock of her life when the email come up on her screen saying they were successful and they'd won this contract and they had to provide for 5 years school meals in 9 primary schools. She was a volunteer who had written this bid and gone for it. And it was all about local sourcing from local farmers, decent food for the kids. And it's been really popular, hugely successful. And of course they apply all the profits straight back into improving the quality of the meals and to growing. And what they're doing now is they're helping a group of parents in Manchester who are going for the tender, the same thing, to join Whole School Meals as a kind of social franchise, if you like, and to help them do the same thing. So, you know, interesting 4 examples in a spectrum. The spectrum there is really, I put an arrow on that, because that's denoting trading. So Roz, if you like, is completely grant dependent with her horse club. It's all grants from people like the Big Lottery and government grants. No earned income, no social enterprise element. Junior gets things called social impact bonds, which is a new kind of innovative tool, finance tool, to saying, if you manage to keep this person out of prison for 2 years, we will pay you the money that it costs you to run that service and a bonus dividend. So he gets independent financiers to come in, stump up the finance, and then they get their money back from the government so long as that person stays out of prison. So he's trading, and he's got this clever little model, and he's one of the social impact bond pilots. Bikeworks, well, you understood Dave's trading model there. And Whole School Meals, well, Stephanie has a huge contract for all these school meals in this area, and doubtless she'll win the re-tendering of that. So it's called the third sector, and this is really what this government is trying to encourage. I mean, this stuff is, you know, we've been doing it for a long time at the School for Social Entrepreneurs, but it's in its infancy, and they want this stuff to go large. They want this to be provision of services, you know, up and down the land, really. And so the concept is, well, it's about localism. It's about saying that a bureaucrat sat in an office is not going to understand the needs of people living on a housing estate in Brixton who have a whole lot of problems, a whole lot of issues, and they're dealing with poverty. They don't have much money. And a bureaucrat, in terms of designing public services to meet that needs of that family and that community, is going to get it wrong. Why don't we empower these citizens to come to the fore? They've got a vested interest. It's their kids, it's their neighbours, it's their community, their family. Why don't we empower them to come to the fore and begin to author solutions and scale solutions that work for their communities? And it really is compelling to see the results of what can be done. So it's actually saying, not big government, it's saying big society, over to the people. People are motivated to do this stuff. They need decent skills and support, appropriate stuff. So, you know, let's not expect the business schools to train people in entrepreneurship as a mug's game. You learn it by doing and you learn it from practitioners. So let's use action learning as a tool to support them. So it's about devolving power, it's about volunteerism, but I've put 3 categories there. I've put startups, scale-outs, and spin-outs, because there's another couple of agendas encompassed in this phrase, big society. And that is, when it's working, Bike Works in East London, let's open another Bike Works in Manchester, where all the stolen bikes from Manchester can be refurbed and people who are depressed can, you know, get out and about and get meaningful occupation. So there is a big agenda around scaling up what works. But interestingly, they don't want these to grow into big charities or big social enterprises. So the idea is to, if you like, use a not-for-profit franchise. So get a bunch of people in Manchester to buy into that club and govern, run, finance their own operations. So the idea is to get leadership locally, so that money is held locally, so that skills and talents of leadership are exercised locally, as opposed to an outpost or a branch of a big national charity. spin-outs. Well, this is the other. This is an enormous agenda in the UK. We are facing the biggest public service cuts for probably 100 years. People cannot contemplate the change that's going on in the UK at the moment. Youth unemployment has absolutely gone through the roof. It's really a desperate situation. And things that we have all taken for granted for generations, libraries, parks, and loads of services in the NHS, which are seen to be kind of non-compulsory, are going to be spun out. Now, loads of people have a problem with that, but it's not going to stop it happening. So we are where we are. And the spin-out agenda, so the government's really championing, they're using a lot of words on television and in the papers around social enterprise, around community interest companies, around mutuals and co-ops, which who would have thought that a right-of-centre government was spending a lot of time on the television talking about co-ops and mutuals and employee-owned partnerships. It's very strange what's going on politically in the UK. And of course, you know, the big questions are, the problem for Cameron and for the coalition government is this is fabulous stuff. It's really great ideas. The evidence is good behind it. It's needed. The problem is it's coincided with an enormous crash in public finances. So the problem is everyone's very cynical about what it's about. They're saying, okay, so you're basically going to chop all the public services and you're expecting the big society to take over. So the problem is the media game is not playing well. Actually, there is a good story in there, but it's being clouded by the cynicism around, you know, what people are seeing as hidden agendas. And philosophical agendas in terms of, you know, shrinking state. But actually, there's a lot of evidence that in many interventions, the state is not doing a good job in terms of, for instance, reoffending of young black men in London. It's doing a terrible job. So let's try a new innovative way. So I'll finish on this. And really, this is trying to distill some of the tensions in this debate. As I say, I mean, obviously the politicians are constantly playing to the media. Now, the thing is, they've got this idea of over to you guys. It's the citizens who are going to run this agenda, not the politicians. It's going to be the big society. You're all going to author the future, not us. But the problem is that's coincided, as I say, with a huge drop in public sector spending. So some of the contradictions that pop up in this is, well, there's this whole thing of charity is the old guard. It's deeply unfashionable charity. It's deeply dependent. It creates dependencies. It's Victorian. It keeps people in crushed down positions. The new nirvana is social enterprise, trading, earning income and reemploying that for social mission. That's all very good and well if you live in Dorset and you have a motivated community that have plenty of money and you can leverage in a bit of philanthropy. But if you try and open up a community cafe in Brixton while benefits have been cut, surprise, surprise, your community cafe, particularly if you're using people maybe who have Down syndrome or mental health difficulties to run that cafe, and nobody has any money in that community, surprise, surprise, social enterprise is not a nirvana, because if the market is broken and people in that community don't have enough money to buy the cappuccino or the whatever it is, surprise, surprise, that cafe will struggle. So there's great stuff that can be done with social enterprise, but we need to temper that message and not pretend that it's something that it isn't. If these communities don't have much money, they don't have much money. The next thing is contract sizes. So what the coalition government have done, is they've issued a whole lot of huge contracts for welfare. We're talking absolutely massive. There's not one charity or social enterprise in the UK that could prime contract for some of these contracts. So inevitably what's happening is we're being told, encouraged to partner up with the private sector, which is great because that gives a fusion of new skills and new energy to the piece. The problem is, again, is the cynicism that brings in, that actually it's a privatisation agenda by the back door. So the media, again, you know, you're talking about localism, You're talking about empowering all the people to push forward their ideas in their communities, but you're issuing contract sizes that are in the hundreds of millions. So how can these people get these contracts? So you're saying one thing and you're doing another. So there's real tensions there amongst that stuff. And I suppose the other point here is, imagine you've got a Bike Works or Ebony Horse Club, and you want to, or Whole School Meals, and you want to open 20 of them around the country. The problem is with social enterprise structures like community interest companies or company limited by guarantee or charities. The problem is you have no equity stakeholding to give out. So you can't go to the market for capital because you can't give ownership to people. And we're being encouraged to think around creative models to try and bring capital in so that we can scale what works and scales what's good. Now, that's difficult because the general public's trust of social enterprise and charity, the reason that a member of the public might choose to buy Café Direct tea, which is fair trade tea, or Divine Chocolate, which is fair trade chocolate, or might choose to buy a bike from Bike Works, is because they understand that there's fairness written into that trading equation. They understand that there's not a leak in the bucket in terms of dividends going out. And therefore, there's a real movement in the UK which is growing social enterprise. It's very exciting. Now, if we do too many deals with financiers or with the private sector, that's fantastic because we can scale what works. But actually, are we playing with our USP or our differential, which is that actually social enterprise is owned by either no one or owned by everyone by way of a co-op or an employee-owned partnership? So again, there's real debates and challenges in there. And I don't, you know, the truth of the matter is the jury's out on the big society in the UK. It had an amazing kicking a couple of weeks ago in the press, and Cameron had to come out and say that it's absolutely, he's going to stick with it, he's not going to ditch it as a policy. But there's rumblings and debate about it right, left and centre, and there's a real call for it to be made more tangible, more real, and ultimately, in terms of, if you want a big society to flourish and you want all these innovative ideas to come to the fore, well, they need some sort of money. You know, they can't be completely unfinanced. And also they need some sort of appropriate support. So there's a kind of missing piece in the jigsaw as yet as to what that's going to look like. So in summary, loads of really exciting, great ideas in there, but the jury's out on delivery, and there's a huge debate in the UK as to how it's going to happen. So I'd be interested to hear what people think about it. Thank you.
So, many thanks. Have we finished with the screen now, Varin? So we can turn that off. So we come to questions and discussion. Thanks, Varin. And we've got till 7 o'clock. We're just talking in the microphone here. Everything should be Bob's your uncle. Tell us about whatever happened to the third way. Those of us who went to Britain and spoke about social matters during the Blair, particularly and to some extent the Brown period, were told a lot about the third way, but whatever happened to the third way on the road to the big society?
The third way laid the path for the big society. All the third way initiatives have bubbled up all these ideas. I mean, it's so interesting in terms of the coming together of politics in the UK. You know, Cameron couldn't look more like Blair if he tried in terms of his policy agenda. And it's an absolute, I mean, there's a direct thread through. I chair something called the Social Entrepreneurship Policy Group, which created the manifesto for social entrepreneurship, social enterprise. And we peddled it round the leaders of all the parties. Every single one of them adopted it wholesale. There's no debate about this stuff. Every party wants to do this stuff. This is not a left-right thing. It's, you know, they all want to do this. They're experiencing problems in how do you finance it and how do you deliver it, and crucially, how do you communicate it and win the public debate in the media. That's where they're failing. Because it's amorphous, it's difficult, it's, it's public sector spin-outs, and it's startups, and it's scale-ups, it's social enterprise, it's trading, it's charities, it's mutuals. It's kind of everything. And that's very difficult, because people say, well, it's kind of nothing then.
So we go there?
As you were speaking, it reminded me of, you know, going back 150 years, 200 years to religious organisations and churches, bubbled up charitable kind of enterprise, but nobody at government level tried to get it into a big picture. And it seems to me there's a contradiction in this. We are trying to get away from bureaucratically led, everybody on the taxpayer milk cart. At the same time, because we formalise it and give it some kind of government ceiling or roof, we then cut off that individuality, and so you're dealing with contradictions.
And
that seems to be, to me, the problem with all of this.
You've spotted it bang on. There's a huge contradiction right at the heart of this. If it's all about big society, it shouldn't be coming from the Prime Minister to tell everyone to do it or how to do it. So there's a, as you say, there's a contradiction right through this. But, I mean, the politicians have got to get involved in this because they've also got to explain what they're doing by way of getting out of the kind of tax addiction and the public service delivery. And that's to do with divesting huge amounts of public services. So they've got to explain what that's all about, and presumably they think that a narrative which includes exciting social innovation, bottom-up alternatives, is better than a narrative which is purely about cuts to public services. So I don't think the muddiness or the lack of clarity is by lack of design. I think the spin doctors have thought about this very carefully, but they've not nailed it, they've not got it right, because people are not understanding it, and certainly the commentators in the more serious press are picking it to bits, you know. But you're exactly right.
Hi, so question over here.
You were speaking about having clean sheets and not involving too much with the private sector in order to not lose trust of the market. How do you overcome the problem that many prospective clients and partners believe that just because you're doing something good, you have to do it for free or cheap? That is like the basis of the problem. Why do people think that way?
Well, I don't know why people think that way, but what's interesting is there's a really exciting thing happening around social enterprise, and that's about the term social enterprise. As I say, it's a baggy term. It's kind of a bit, you can define it how you wish. Essentially, what it's talking about is trading and then re-employing the trading for a social purpose. Now, if you look at the British Social Attitudes Survey, which is a public trust and confidence survey that happens every year, and it looks at institutions and trust in institutions. So it looks at levels of public trust in the church, in Marks and Spencers, in the army, in charities, in social enterprise, in the banks, in politicians. Guess who's at the bottom of the entire rung? The politicians and the banks. Guess who's at the top? Social enterprise and charities. The general public don't understand social enterprise, but they know somehow that there's fairness written into it. So, like, if you're picking up tea bags in the supermarket and you decide to go fair trade as opposed to your normal Tetley tea or whatever, Lipton's as you have over here, you know, there's a consumer choice there, which is about paying a slight premium because you understand that the farmer's getting a better rate or etc. Now, this movement is growing consumer-wise in the UK multiple percentages a year. It's a very exciting movement. Now, the problem for social enterprise is we do want to play with the private sector. You know, we know the talent. We want to get engaged in partnership. The problem is, if we do partnerships to access these huge contracts, then the general public will say, well, actually, we thought you were different, and we thought you were re-employing what would have been dividends for a social mission, but actually, you're in bed with the banks, you're in bed with all the people that we don't trust. So this movement, which really is has huge kind of wind in its sails, could come a cropper if we're not careful about, one, the deals that we do, and two, how we communicate the deals that we do. Yeah,
it's more about how you communicate it, in my point of view, because if you successfully tell them what you will do with the collaboration, then they will buy it, because we trust you as a person and you're able to tell us what to do with the money. So the private sector is a great asset, access to money. And
absolutely, but you only gamble with public trust once. You only lose it once. Now, the banks have lost public trust in the UK, absolutely. And surprise, surprise, the banks are saying to the social enterprise movement at the moment in the UK, we need to capitalise what works. So let's work out a way of popping equity into Bike Works, into Whole School Meals, etc., to scale them up, and let's do more of it, because we want to replicate this stuff, we want to make it grow. But what they're effectively doing is taking away, potentially, the USP, or the difference of the social enterprise, which is the fact that actually any surpluses didn't go to dividends, shareholders, they went back into the model. So it's a choice, and this is a big society thing, and I absolutely, you know, if you think of some of the wonderful social businesses that have happened, led by social entrepreneurs like Anita Roddick with the Body Shop, pure for-profit, brilliant business, employs thousands of people, makes great profits and gives out dividends. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. We should be championing social business and doing loads more of it. But we need to help people understand what is what in this, in order that we can still build and move a social enterprise movement. It's tricky, nuanced stuff.
Okay, John, we go there. Right, yep.
So I was wondering if the government has a concept like a voucher system, like, for example, for Bike Works, where, as you said, on Saturday mornings, people who might be on medication are not taking medication. Is the government prepared, or the guys that could possibly go back to jail, are they prepared to put their money where their mouth is and support in some way those initiatives?
Absolutely. What they've done is, because we've got no money in Britain, we're skint, we've come up with something called the Big Society Bank. The Big Society Bank goes alongside the Big Society. The idea behind it is dormant bank accounts. So all of you, when you were students, you might have had a bank account that had $40 in it that you forgot about 20 years ago. Now that $40 is now worth a whole load more. We've passed an Act of Parliament to take from the banks all those dormant bank accounts and bring it into a fund called the Big Society Fund, a Big Society Bank, and that is, you know, it's a lot of money, and that will act as, I don't want to make this too complicated, but it'll act as a wholesaler to a whole load of other social investors, and that will be the kind of fuel behind this. And in answer to your other question about Bike Works or about Junior and SOS Gangs project, yes, so three primary care trusts in East London, the doctors write prescriptions which Bike Works can cash in for money as a result of the volunteering. So not drugs, but, you know, which is incredible. And also with Junior, the social impact bonds, the other kind of thrust of the new government is really about payment by results. So it's not about saying to a private sector organisation or a charity or a social enterprise, we will pay for you to run this big probation service and employ loads of workers and all the rest of it. They won't do that. What they'll say is, we're not going to give you any money, but if you keep, you know, out of 100 people, if you keep 70 of them out of prison for 2 years when they've come out of prison, we will give you X number of pounds per prisoner. And you, what you've got to do is you've got to go to financiers and say, it's called a social impact bond, you've got to say, can you stump up the cash for the 2 years so I can employ the workers, make this happen, and then we'll pay it back. So yes, they're doing. The problem is, again, there's a bloody problem with this. The problem is there's a gap. So the policies come in, the rhetoric's there, the ideas are there, but all these systems aren't set up and the money's not flowing. So meanwhile, a lot of great innovative stuff is going to the wall. So, you know, this is a really difficult time.
It's a question then. Yeah.
I think you're saying that some seed capital from government is necessary, but if we look at the private enterprise analogy with small business, more than 50% of it go broke, I assume there'll be a lot of failures in this. And the government doesn't have a sense of humour with that. I mean, our regulators in this country cease prosecuting if they lose two cases. It takes another 3 or 4 years to have the courage to suffer the test headlines again. Now, what future is there for a government backing these things in light of the fact that there'll be many, many failures?
Yeah, I mean, you're quite right. Their propensity to risk, or their attitude to risk, in terms of entrepreneurship, new ideas that work for prisoners being released from prison, is very poor, it's very low. One, because they can't cope with the media that goes around it. If you invest, you know, a couple of million in a reoffenders project in Brixton, and everyone reoffends, politically it's a nightmare in the press. So that is a bit of an issue in terms of... But, so what they're doing is they're, if you like, offshoring that. So they're finding financiers to come in, take the risk, back the brave, innovative ideas, and then down track when it delivers, they will reimburse the financier. That's the idea. And it's because of the... It's partly because of the media and the political narrative that they've got to do these kind of fancy things. In the old days, you would have just paid for this.
Hang on, just a second. There's a project of social engineering the Sydney Institute is sponsoring, which is to drown mobile phones. You get a bucket and you drown them. I think we'll get to the government. We'll get some sort of subsidy. It'll be an entrepreneurial business.
As long as you don't drown palms, we're all right.
Yeah, Stuart.
Just to expand on Jared's question, if Cameron is a shadow of Tony Blair, what is Ed Miliband and Labor doing to differentiate themselves?
So that's down the back. The question is, if Cameron is a shadow of Tony Blair, what is Ed Miliband and others doing to differentiate themselves from the Labor government, from the Labor opposition?
They're stuffed. At the moment, they're doing nothing. What they're doing is they're regrouping and they're trying to work out what the narrative is and what the differential is and what they can take forward. But at the moment, there's nothing coming out. They're very, very quiet. There's a trap, obviously, which is because of these public sector cuts. The unions are absolutely, you know, so they'll be marching in the streets and the unions are absolutely up in arms about all the public sector cuts. So there is a narrative that Ed Miliband could follow, which is these cuts are dreadful, but, you know, then the general public will say, well, we've got to get the deficit down. So he's in a tricky position. And also, the truth of the matter is, progressive people in Labour absolutely embrace all the notions behind big society, around localism, empowerment of local communities, social entrepreneurship, social enterprise, social impact bonds, the whole lot they agree with. So it's very difficult. And it does come out of... I mean, I've worked with the ministers on this stuff for 12 years, and it's completely interchangeable. I mean, you know, you've got one chap sitting in front of you who's got one rosette on and another one with another. They're saying the same things, you know. I mean, it so happens this lot have got no money and the last lot had plenty of money, but they're saying the same thing.
There's a question here. Let me go over there. Yeah.
Well, we have a situation in Australia where you have Aborigines in remote communities being destroyed by welfare, and huge amounts of money are spent on welfare services and for the public service who administer them. On the other hand, you go up to Queensland and you've got an Aboriginal leader, Noel Pearson, who seems to be doing something like what you're suggesting. I do hope when you're in Australia you might have a chance to meet him.
I've certainly heard of Noel, and I think this is really exciting because in the room there's a few people who work for the School for Social Entrepreneurs in Australia, and Benny, the chief exec, is over here, and it's a remarkable little institution. But I think what's so exciting about the School for Social Entrepreneurs in Australia is they employ this thing called action learning methodology. So you learn by doing and you learn from practitioners, and hence you're working on the soft skills and the hard skills. Yes, the business plan writing and the finance and the trading and all the rest of it, but you're learning about the soft skills. Now, Aboriginal communities, in terms of learning from storytelling and learning from doing and passing through generations, this stuff really chimes, and we're finding with all sorts of diverse communities in the UK that action learning and social entrepreneurship is a real way of, as opposed to kind of Victorian doing stuff to people endlessly and endlessly pouring money at social problems, we're finding that if people can get relaxed enough to say, what are your ideas? Come on a program, learn to practitioners, learn from your peers, learn from each other, and let's actually give a bit of power in terms of legal structure and finance, you know, legal structure that can hold finance to communities that are experiencing struggles and problems, then surprise, surprise, it works. So I think it's really exciting that this model is working in Australia, and I think it's really exciting to think of, at the moment we've not done any kind of dedicated programs looking at Aboriginal communities, but I think it'd be really exciting if we did in the future.
Now, someone down here, do you still want to go? Hang on a second. Do you want to have a go? Yeah. Okay, so then we'll go, where were we? We'll go over here, yeah. Fred.
Problem with Cape York and that they're suffering, the two Pearson brothers, Noel and Gerhardt, and they've done a number of things, a tuna fishing enterprise, a broadband company that we're running that I'm involved in. Well, the problems they're facing is the Greens and their power over the Labor government in Queensland that destroyed a whole series of initiatives they had for ecotourism, locally run, like the Maoris are doing in New Zealand, but very successfully, by locking up all the wild rivers and denying access to them for Indigenous enterprise.
This so, follows up the question about Noel Pearson, just for those at the back. And the suggestion is that Noel Pearson and Cape York are suffering problems with the intervention of the Greens, who don't want ecotourism, and in cooperation with the state government, is trying to stop these social entrepreneurial initiatives. Right? Yeah. I mean, you're not an expert on Australia.
No, I mean, tricky. I mean, it's a tricky balance.
Sorry, it's just a
interesting
comment, so you're aware of it. But
yeah.
An issue. Social entrepreneurs face this issue of acceptance by, in this country, by government and by others. There's a group of merchant bankers who put together a fantastic idea, which was for provide housing at low price for people like police, nurses, etc., so they could live in Sydney. And the concept there was that it would be joint ownership and that over time they could be bought out so that the equity increase goes to both sides. But getting buy-in from superannuation funds to invest in it, it's just been a long process.
Shared ownership is huge in the UK. It's absolutely massive. We've won that argument 10, 15 years ago.
There's a question down there. Yeah, then we go over here. Yep.
You referred a couple of times to the media not quite understanding the point that's happening now. And if you have newspapers like The Guardian, for example, publishing maps of all the people in the UK and rely on the public sector or children in poverty, I think the whole thing's becoming very graphic for people. Do you anticipate that the government will keep the course, or do you anticipate that they will in some way crumble in the face of this onslaught?
And well, as I say, Cameron had to come out 2 weeks ago and say, we're doing the big society, we're not going to drop it. So the fact that he came out and said that means I don't think they can now drop it. I think they need to do a couple of things. They need to make it more tangible. So in other words, there need to be programs with money attached to make it more real. I think they will do that. Because hanging around the back is a whole load of well-known chief execs of large charities and social enterprises in the UK, and if they get themselves, if they galvanise and put joint letters into the media, they're in big, big trouble. So if the third sector, if you like, the social enterprise charities, turn on this idea and say it's nothing but a fig leaf for public sector cuts, then the politicians are in trouble. So I think there is a bit of a, they need to begin to put a little bit of money. I mean, back to the lady that sat over here, she's quite right. You know, we do have a huge problem. We don't want like to replace like. We do need to cut costs and be more effective at delivering effective public services. But at the same time, you can't wipe it out. You can't do social enterprise or social entrepreneurship or new ideas with nothing in poor communities. It's impossible. So there needs to, and above and beyond the big society bank, there needs to be real policy initiatives with teeth and money. It's not a lot of money, you know, but there needs to be some meaningful stuff. And I think they probably sussed that, and I think they're probably a little bit nervous of how it might play out, and so I think it might become a bit more real and tangible. I'm only guessing, though.
Question down the back there. Yeah.
I must say that many company directors and senior managers volunteer their services to organisations to help them develop and to guide them on their way through. Do you have any sense in which you use this kind of available resource, and if not, do you think you should?
Yeah, well, so in the UK we have a whole load of schools for social entrepreneurs up and down the country, and we have what we call sector partnerships in the UK with Barclay Card, with PricewaterhouseCoopers, with SVG Capital, with a whole load of big private sector companies. And what they do is they pay bursaries to put through somebody through the School for Social Entrepreneurs. So they kind of watch, they hear, they get a 3-minute pitch from the people with the ideas, and they say, okay, I'll pay for you to go to the School for Social Entrepreneurs and make that happen. And then they also provide a mentor for that person. So in terms of employee engagement and volunteerism, there's loads of that. And it works very, very well, actually, in terms of mentoring and involvement. And I know the School for Social Entrepreneurs in Australia does the same. But if people know of companies and have access to talented people in private sector companies who can mentor social entrepreneurs and support them, it's an exciting thing to do. And I'm sure Benny and the team would love to speak to anyone who's got ideas.
I mean rather at the structure of your enterprise, that you would have input or a board or some management structure that would help you to decide how to approach the companies that might then mentor the entrepreneurs that you have.
Yeah, I mean, I've got people on my board who are pretty well connected in the business world and who can help me get around and about. But it's crucial.
Just a quick question on your bike example. I mean, what do you say to the bloke who, or the woman who is running a small bike shop, and they run a small business, and this social entrepreneurial activity is going to cut across what they want to do commercially? I mean, to what extent is this rivaling people in small business?
They better step up their game. Competition's in town. It's a free market. I mean, you know, it's a social enterprise.
But it's not the free market if you're getting bikes from the police for nothing and other people are assisting you to sell them. I mean, they can't get bikes from the police for nothing, presumably.
Yeah, I know, but they are not employing employees who have severe mental illnesses. So it's a different game. Consumers are choosing to buy bikes from Bike Works at a premium. You know, if you look at Bike Works showroom and you look at the tags on all the bikes, I wouldn't be paying that for a second-hand bike on eBay. But people are taking their kids there and they're choosing to buy those bikes because they know what Bike Works is doing. So it's a positive consumer choice, and I think consumers will drive this market when they get their heads around what social enterprise is all about. And, you know, great bike shops will need to innovate and try different things to keep ahead of the game. But
okay, so I think we've got the final question here. We might have time for there. Yeah, we've got to be brief.
Yep, the term big society, I think, remember when Lyndon Johnson ran for president, he was using that term, my memory is correct. I don't know what became of his big society.
The Great Society. The exact opposite.
It's just a commitment.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he spent a lot of money, that's for sure. He really did. Look, I think we can end up here.
I run something called the Entrepreneurial Chase, which is we teach young minds not to get a job, but how to create jobs and opportunities for others. And we told our members, I will be here today and meet you. And we think the global issues will be solved by the entrepreneurs and especially the young ones of today. What do you think I should tell my members what they should think about in terms of pitching for funding for social initiatives? and not business initiatives, because it's easier for them to motivate a business initiative because then you can talk in terms of money. But how? What should they think about?
I mean, this is the kind of issue or the problem at the heart of social enterprise. It is to do with blending mission with money. Now, we tend to think in binary terms. It's easier if you're running a business and you're just trying to hit the bottom line and make profit, or you're just trying to do good and support people who have problems. What's difficult is when you blend those propositions of mission or money. But it's also very interesting when you blend them, and it's more sustainable when you blend them. So, I mean, I commend what you're doing. Absolutely, in the UK, entrepreneurship is the only way out of this mess, both commercial entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship. I'm not bothered. It so happens that I run the School for Social Entrepreneurs, but commercial entrepreneurship is equally as valid in this environment. We need to create jobs, get meaningful occupation for young people, and not have a generation of people on the scrap heap, you know, welfare dependent, you know, just having not good lives. So, what I would say to them, if I was speaking to them, is go for it. You know, don't procrastinate. You know, pilot what you're doing, have a go, and go for it. You know.
Final quick question. You're right. So we're happy to end there. I think it's a good ending. Okay. Many thanks. I'll get in here and say say something. Entrepreneurial. Yes. Thanks for Simon Edwards, who did the introduction today, who told us about this, Alistair Wilson's visit. Thanks to the School for Social Entrepreneurs, Beth Worrell, who helped us with this, and also Benny Callahan's here today, so thanks for that. And of course to our speaker, Alistair Wilson. And I've had a lot of discussions about these matters over the years, but I've never really had one that I fully understood, actually. Particularly in Britain, I've come away knowing a lot but understanding not much at all. But today I've actually learned, and I think it's because our speaker's spoken about examples and in an empirical sense about what is a theoretical topic, but also speaking in an empirical sense about examples and exactly what's going on. So we're very grateful that Alistair Wilson could find time to drop off during his time in Australia to talk for the Sydney Institute. The talk will be up on our website, on the podcast, on our website tomorrow. And the paper will be published in time in the Sydney papers online. But I've learned a lot tonight. I'm sure we all have. So many thanks to Alistair Wilson. Thanks a lot.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.